All right, on the final, we're going to have questions on contracts. Basically the same type of question you had on your midterm. Same type of format. Again, it is closed book, closed note. It's a take home. I really think you'd be able to finish this in 3 hours or less. And I'm going to be sending it out either tonight or tomorrow, sometime before tomorrow night. And keep in mind, I only have 72 hours to grade them all, so please get them in on time. All right. There'll also be questions on torts. There'll also be questions on real property. Let's take a look at a typical question. You have a question which involves, perhaps, a contract. And by the way, the problems are not necessarily one and one only. I can have a problem where, as we noted, with the property, there's a question of negligence, which is tort, or land, rules involving land, or it might be rules involving contract and land. So they all connect with each other. So you're going to have to be looking at all the aspects of these questions, depending upon how the question is written. So, suppose there's a question about a contract. Well, if I say there's a contract, you can use that as a good starting point. You might want to test it to make sure that the contract is a valid contract, but if I say there's a contract, you can assume that there was an offer and acceptance and whatever else is part of that general definition. I will typically say that the contract is a verbal or oral contract if it's not written. So I'll make the point if there's which you should be looking for, a statute of fraud issue. Much like the midterm, I would expect that you'd be looking for whether it's entire or severable. But then, again, those type of questions go to the remedy, and we're still building whether this is a good contract. Again, what is a contract? Contract is an agreement between two or more competent parties reached upon offer and acceptance relating to a competent subject matter requiring legal consideration and mutuality of obligation. Did I say it has a meeting of the minds? Requiring a meeting of the minds of all parties thereto, and set forth such that its terms are ascertainable and not overly vague or uncertain, that creates, modifies, or destroys a legal relationship. Just going down that list gives you a whole bunch of things to be looking for. Is there any problems here? If there's no problems, don't write about it. Check for the statute of frauds, if applicable. Check if the... Now you're going to be checking all kinds of other things. We spoke about whether things are possible or impossible, subjectively impossible or objectively impossible. What hidden words might be in there? Do we have a problem where we're going to have to be concerned with somebody using good faith? Do we have absolute or limited discretion in various parts of reviews? Exactly what is it that we're agreeing to? Including the invisible ink. You're trying to guess how a judge would rule in this particular case. You're trying to act as though you're the judge in this particular case. All right, and then you have to decide whether the obligations have been met, discharged, either by performance or by some other means. And if they have not, and there has been a breach of contract, where we're going to go from here? What remedies do we have? Keep in mind, the court doesn't want to hear this over and over again, so don't put out specific performance that you're going to go tell somebody to go give it a better look. If they used bad faith the first time, no, that's not going to work. And if I tell someone to go paint somebody else's house, you know we're going to be back in court arguing whether the enforced specific performance paint job was done properly. You don't want to have that. You want a judgment that is going to settle the matter once and for all. Going to torts. Well, we went through the intentional torts. You're not supposed to go and hit somebody. You're not supposed to threaten to hit somebody or touch somebody. False imprisonment, which one of the examples brought before class, and there was even an example there. Chaining a door for security. Is this false imprisonment? Person can't get out. If you don't have somebody there to let them out, and somebody gets stuck in there, you may have a problem. Know what is defamation, what is not defamation. If I call Senator McCain a Democrat, that is not defamation. It may be inaccurate. But it's not defamation. If I call Senator Lieberman a Republican, that's not defamation. It may be inaccurate, but it's not defamation. If I say that somebody who is competing against me for a job on building a new office or a new plant for the meatpacking company, that this person's a vegetarian, is that defamation? Assuming it's not true again. We noted that is not defamation. We don't immediately say that a vegetarian is somebody who is a horrible, horrible person, that we would not never want to deal with that person. On the other hand, hey, if you're going to be building a new office for my meatpacking plant, it would be nice if you like meat. A reasonable person under those circumstances would say, your missed statement about me is not appreciated. If it's true, it's true. Is it going to kill the deal automatically? Not necessarily, but it's certainly not going to help me win the job. And if it's true, it's true. But if it's not true, well, is that defamation? No. It was presenting somebody in a false light. One of the right to privacy torts. If I claim that I'm endorsed by somebody who I'm not endorsed by, that person has... I haven't defamed this person. In fact, I've given them the highest compliment possible. But they would have a right to privacy claim against me. Similarly, if I go out, and those are the two false ones. And how about the true ones? If I acquire information improperly with a telephoto lens, for example, well, it was wrong for me to acquire it, and because it was wrong for me to acquire it, it's wrong for me to disseminate that information. How about if I received information which I received properly, but only because of our special relationship? So I tell your employer how badly you did on a particular question on the exam. No, I have to hold that information in confidence. So in both those cases, I'm saying the exact truth, but again, it would be a right to privacy tort. Moving into property, we've had a bit of discussion about easements. and how they can grow beyond where you expected them to go. We've had some discussion about what are the duties of a landlord and what are the duties of a tenant to third parties who are visiting the tenant's property. We've talked about lateral and subjacent support at least once. We've talked about riparian rights. Trying to think back to last week, as we were getting into land, some of the other issues involving property rights. What's a fixture? Who has the right to that fixture? I paint a mural on the wall of my apartment. Who owns that mural? Anyone want to suggest? Can I take that mural with me when I leave? No. Can I paint over it when I leave? Can I put it back in its original pristine condition? If that painting is of any value, if that mural is of any value, I'm in a horrible position now. I painted the wall. The landlord, if the landlord likes the mural, he or she can keep it. If the landlord doesn't like the mural, the landlord can have it removed and charge me for putting it back in its original condition. What did I do wrong? I painted on the wall without asking permission first. If I hang a $10,000 chandelier in my apartment, who owns the chandelier? As soon as it is affixed to the ceiling, it belongs to the landlord. And the landlord says, my next tenant who comes into this apartment, I don't want them having an apartment with a chandelier, because if it, under normal wear and tear, if it breaks, I guess I'm the one who has to fix it. I'm taking the $10,000 chandelier down. I'm putting back the original fixture that belongs there. Who gets to keep the chandelier? Landlord. Who gets charged for the labor in putting back the original fixture? The former tenant. Landlord wins, all three ways that way. This is not a you win, I win situation. Let's see what else we can say about fixtures. Yes. Okay, if major appliances, depending upon the community, a refrigerator may or may not be considered to be a fixture. Typically, I would say it's not, but again, some communities would say it is. If you sell a house and you don't say anything, the refrigerator you take with you because you plug it in into a outlet. An electric range is typically hardwired in. It's not plugged in. And if it's hardwired in, there's no question about it. It is a fixture. Now, how about that refrigerator, which has the water line in it for the automatic ice maker? Can we say that we have it's become a fixture because of that? Local community is going to be a way that it's resolved in each community. I'm going to say that if you plugged in a refrigerator and you unplug it, you can disconnect the that little quarter-inch water line also. Same with the washer-dryer. The dryer, typically, you're plugging in to a 220 line. Yeah, but you're still plugging it in. And yet, although plugging it in makes it into a movable as opposed to a fixture, Again, we're going to have to probably go with what is the rule in that local community. I would start off by saying, again, if it's plugged in, it's not a fixture. Again, go down to the Philadelphia International Airport, Terminal A. Look up at the lamps that hang from the ceiling. They are connected to the ceiling. They hang from the ceiling on wires, which have hooks at the end and hold the lamp in place, lamp structure in place. And the lamp structure has a long black cord that plugs into an outlet on the ceiling, which means it's immovable, not a fixture. This is not necessarily going into the test here. We're going into a little bit beyond that. And again, well, what's the advantage here? Why was it done that way? Well, if this was a private property as opposed to public, I would say, well, if it's affixed to the ceiling, it's a fixture. And therefore, it is depreciated over 39 years under the tax code. And if you plug it in to the ceiling instead, it's immovable and it's depreciated over either 3, 5, or 7 years, depending upon its classification. I think lamps are 3 year, but they might be 5 year. I don't think they're 7 year. Keep in mind, same thing, signage on the side of a building. Bolted in place, or welded in place. Depreciated with the cost of the building, over 39 years. Hung from the sign with a little plug on a hook. Couple hooks and then plugged in to an outlet. Movable, depreciable over a short period of time. Huge savings to your client, if you're an architect, based upon whether you have made these things movable or fixtures. Now, why does the airport have this? The airport doesn't care, I presume, for that purpose. And again, I'm not quite sure, but my best guess is, if it's affixed, then it has to be handled by one. Then maintenance has to be handled by one unit. Whereas if it's a movable lamp, maintenance is handled by a different union that might have more agreeable terms as far as the airport authority is concerned. I presume I answered your question on that. Going down the questions, let's see. Insurance. If I leave my stove on when I go out for the evening and I left my stove on and it causes a fire and burns down my house, what caused the burning down of my house? My negligence, is that correct? I was definitely at fault. It's my fault the house burnt down. And does that mean that Allstate is not going to pay me? What am I insuring against? I'm insuring against the possibility that I am human and I have been known to err and I might be negligent. Now, if I deliberately set fire to my house, Allstate is not going to pay. But if I'm negligent, that's what I'm insuring against. Everyone clear on that? Okay. Next, let's talk about bonding for a moment. Sureties. The surety bond is, I guarantee X, and that's all I guarantee, if B does not perform for A. Does my bond, absent other language, relieve B of any other damages other than payment of this stipulated sum? No. In fact, I'm going to go back, try and get it back from B also, aren't I? But the important point here is, if I have a bond, which I set the bond at $1,000, and because you didn't perform, I have $5,000 in losses. What Could I sue you? If there was no bond, what would I sue you for? $5,000. If I sued you for $5,000 and you didn't have $5,000, what would I could win the lawsuit, but what would I collect? Zero, right? What's the purpose of the bonding company? They guarantee that there's at least $1,000 sitting out there. The first $1,000 I'm guaranteed to get because there's someone we know has deep pockets with that $1,000. But I'm still coming after you for the other four. Of course, I'm going to have to wait in line because the bonding company's coming after you for that first $1,000 too. See, bonding, landlords, corporations. When's a corporation die? When the state says it died. When the state allows it to close down. Suppose the person who owns the corporation, owns 100% of the shares of the corporation, dies. What happens to the corporation? Goes to that shareholder's heirs. How about if the management all dies on a plane crash? Who cares? All right, just, you know, going down various issues here. I don't know. I think I've covered most of what I need to do as far as a review. Does anyone have any specific questions for the final? Yes. I think it's 14. I'm not sure. I'll have to go look. I just don't remember. Yes. The whole book. It's a cumulative final. Yes. However, I will sort of suggest that I have talked about all the problems somehow in this review. And this review is recorded. Yes. I did not put any questions in. I did not put any questions in on intellectual property. Okay, I was waiting for Mr. Dunleavy to help me with that, but we're just not doing it in this iteration. And again, next iteration for the summer may have some questions like that. Any other questions?